Good afternoon, and welcome to the April meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Hedges Hall at Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. A particular welcome to our public radio audience, reaching us through the good offices of the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, MPBN. I'm Dick Snyder, filling in for Mac DeFord, who's president of the forum and who's braving the winter weather in Key West, Florida. Founded in 1983, the forum is now in its 32nd year of bringing you, on a monthly basis, informed speakers on all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomacy. I believe this is our 378th such monthly meeting. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum is today honored to present John Kiriakou. John was for 15 years an employee of the CIA. He's fluent in Arabic and Greek and served first as a Middle East analyst specializing in Iraq. Following several years at the American Embassy in Bahrain, as an economic officer, he returned to Washington, D.C., where he was focusing on Iraq until 1998, when he transferred to the CIA's Directorate of Operations. He became a counterterrorism operations officer and worked in Athens, Greece, on Euro-communist terrorism. And following the September 11th terrorist attacks, Kiriakou was named chief of counterterrorist operations in Pakistan. In 2004, he resigned from the CIA after 15 years of service. During that time in the CIA, he received 10 Exceptional Performance Awards, a Sustained Superior Performance Award, the Counterterrorism Service Medal, and the State Department's Meritorious Honor Award. No mean feat. Everything changed in 2007 when he gave an interview on ABC News that confirmed the CIA's use of waterboarding and torture. The government subsequently brought charges against him, and in 2012, in a plea deal, he was convicted of disclosing classified information, for which he was sentenced to 30 months in a low-security federal prison in Pennsylvania. John has paid dearly for his being a whistleblower. He spent over 2 years separated from his wife and 5 young children. He is not allowed to vote. He has amassed an enormous legal bill. He's had to take minimum wage jobs, and he's lost his government pension. But despite that, he says he would do it all over again. He's the author of Reluctant Spy, My Secret Life in the CIA's War on Terror, and is featured in the award-winning documentary Silenced, a movie that I urge everyone to see. He's an associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and a blogger for Huffington Post, and a frequent guest on TV and radio programs, and his articles have appeared in numerous newspapers and blogs. He's won numerous awards, including the 2012 Joe Calloway Award for Civic Courage, which is awarded for national security whistleblowers who stood up for constitutional rights and American values at great risk to their own personal and professional lives. In November 2013, he was awarded the Peacemaker of the Year Award by the Peace and Justice Center of Sonoma County. Perhaps the most important award he's received is the Penn First Amendment Award, given by the prestigious Penn Center USA, for his continuing writing while in prison. My favorite award is the Giraffe Hero Commendation, awarded to people who stick their necks out for the common good. We are honored to have John Kiriakou stick his neck out today. Thank you, John.
That's welcome.
Thank you. My life really changed when I went to Pakistan in January 2002 as the chief of counterterrorism operations. I had only been in the country, for a couple of weeks when We got word that Abu Zubaydah was somewhere in Pakistan. Abu Zubaydah, we believed at the time, was the number three in Al-Qaeda. Certainly, he was a bad man. He was Al-Qaeda's logistician. If you needed a safe house, you went to Abu Zubaydah. If you needed a false passport or a ticket home or a weapons training program, you went to Abu Zubaydah. If you needed to escape during the bombing of Tora Bora, you went to Abu Zubaydah. So this was a very bad man. It turned out he had never actually joined Al-Qaeda, but it was really irrelevant. Well, we got orders that Abu Zubaydah was somewhere in Pakistan and we had to catch him. The problem is that Pakistan is the size of Texas and it has 230 million people. So to say he's somewhere in Pakistan, go catch him, is an utter non-starter. But believe it or not, 6 weeks later, we caught him in a safe house in Faisalabad, Pakistan, one of the worst places on earth. I'm going to make a very long story very short. As we were breaking down the door to get into his house, he was jumping from the roof of that house to the roof of the neighboring house in order to try to escape. And he was shot by a Pakistani policeman who was standing on the ground. He was shot, his bodyguard was shot, and a Syrian bomb maker with whom he was holed up was also shot. We weren't sure that this was Abu Zubaydah. We only had a six-year-old passport photo of Abu Zubaydah. And this guy didn't look anything like the passport photo. The photo showed a young man in his early 20s, thin, small, a very closely cropped beard and mustache, very handsome. The guy we caught was fat, clean-shaven, had wild Albert Einstein hair. I said, this doesn't look anything like Abu Zubaydah. I don't think it's him. An analyst in Islamabad told me, get a picture of his eye. We can run a retinal scan. His eyes were rolled back into his head. I said, look, he's bleeding to death. He was just laying in a pool of his own blood. And his eyes were rolled back into his head. I said, I can't get a picture of his eye. He said, take a picture of his ear. I didn't know until that night that no two people on earth have the same ears. They're like fingerprints. So I took a picture of his ear. I put it in my phone because phones couldn't take pictures in 2002. And I sent it. And he sent it to headquarters, and headquarters said, it's him. So we took him to the worst place on earth, Faisalabad Hospital. By now it's about 3:20 in the morning. We get to Faisalabad Hospital. Doors and windows are open. Cats and dogs are wandering up and down the halls. Swarms of mosquitoes are feasting on people's open wounds. It was disgusting. There was a bar of Irish Spring soap that I saw. I talk about this in the book. It had syringes coming out of it. And if you needed a shot, the doctor took a syringe, put medicine in it, gave you the shot, and stuck it back in the bar of Irish Spring. So here's this team of Americans dressed as Pakistanis with a wounded, dying Arab bursting into the hospital at 3:20 a.m. And we told the stunned doctor, you have to save this man's life. Our orders were very specific to take him alive. So they wheeled him into surgery, and much to our chagrin, word got around the Al-Qaeda community. We obviously hadn't caught all of them, but word got around the Al-Qaeda community that we had gotten him. And so they started driving by the hospital and just opening fire on the hospital. And so I said to a Pakistani major with whom I was dealing that night, I said, can you get a helicopter in here? If they realize we're unarmed, we're all dead. 20 minutes later, a helicopter landed in the parking lot. I just walked into the operating room and I said to the doctor, let's wrap it up. We have to go. The doctor sewed him closed as quickly as he could. We put him on the helicopter and flew him to a military base. We flew him to a nearby military base. He was in a coma for the first 24 hours. And again, my orders were not to leave his bedside. I ended up sitting in a chair at the foot of his bed for 56 hours. And so a couple of things happened. I wasn't sure what to do, to tell you the truth. I had never found myself in a situation like this before, and I was afraid that I would fall asleep. and he would magically get up out of the bed and run away, and then my career would be ruined. So I tore up a sheet and I tied him to the bed. I didn't fall asleep, but I was afraid that I would. I called a colleague of mine at our nearby safe house and I said, "Hey, listen, would you do me a favor? I'm really dirty and I need some fresh clothes. I have a pair of underwear, a pair of socks, and a t-shirt." The t-shirt was a shirt that my children had bought me that I slept in. It was a red t-shirt with a decal of SpongeBob SquarePants in the middle of it. So I put that on with my big poofy Pakistani pants and sat again at the foot of the bed. After 24 hours, Abu Zubaydah began coming to, and I stood up at the foot of the bed with my hands on my hips, and I was looking at him. And he opened one eye, and you could see the exact instant that he realized, "Oh my God, the Americans have me." Because he looked at SpongeBob, and the heart monitor went from 110 to 220 like this. And it began beeping, beep, 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 beep. And then you hear code blue, and the doctor comes in and they shock him and they gave him Demerol and then he was out again. So about 6 hours later, he comes to again and he opens his eyes and he's very upset when he sees me. And remember, he's tied down. So he motions for me to come over. And I moved his mask and I said, "Shu'ismek, what is your name?" And he shook his head. So I repeated it, "Shu'ismek." And he said to me in beautiful English, "I will not speak to you in God's language." And I said, "That's okay, Abu Zubaydah. We know who you are." And he said, "Give me a glass of red wine." Just then the doctor walked in and I looked at the doctor and I said, "Did he ask for wine?" And the doctor said, "Oh, he's hallucinating," and gave him more Demerol, and then he was out again. So another 6 hours passed. He wakes up and motions for me to come over. I moved the oxygen mask. I said, "What can I do for you?" And he started to cry, and he said, "Please kill me, brother. Take the pillow and smother me." And I said, "Nobody's going to kill you, Abu Zubaydah. We've been looking for you for a long time. You have to pay for your crimes," I told him. "There are 3,000 American lives on your head, and you're going to have to pay." And he said he never wanted to attack the United States. He wanted to attack Israel. He said specifically he wanted to kill Jews, but he had been overruled, that bin Laden had insisted that the attacks be against the United States. As if this was somehow mitigating, as if somehow he was supposed to find mercy in the fact that he wanted to kill Jews. And I said, "There were 50,000 people in those towers that morning. Did you think we wouldn't come after you? Did you think we wouldn't try to kill you and everybody around you? You're lucky you're alive. You're lucky we wanted you alive." So he was upset with that. We had a couple of other conversations over the course of the next 2 days. He cried a lot. He said he would never know the touch of a woman. He would never know the joy of fatherhood. He wrote a lot of poetry and he wanted to recite poetry. We debated Islam versus Christianity. And then he became very concerned about what was going to happen to him. Frankly, he didn't want to be smothered. He wanted to live. And I said, "I honestly don't know what's going to happen to you." I said, "I do know that you're going to get the best medical care that the American government can provide." And indeed, George Tenet had asked the CIA's executive director, who happened to sit on the board of Johns Hopkins University, to ask Johns Hopkins Hospital to send its top trauma surgeon to Pakistan. And they did, on a private jet. And he arrived in the middle of the night in order to escort Abu Zubaydah to his onward location, a secret prison. I didn't know that there was such a thing as a secret prison. I didn't have a need to know. And so the plane landed and Abu Zubaydah asked me to hold his hand as we carried him out to the plane. It was like a 50s era steel gurney. It weighed as much as he did. And three FBI agents and I physically carried him out while I was holding his hand with my other hand. We maneuvered him onto the plane, put him on the luggage rack at the back of the plane, and tied the luggage rack down. In the meantime, one of the rendition officers got off the plane, completely clad in black, black hood, black mask, the whole business. And he said, John? I said, who are you? And he lifted up his mask, and I recognized him as my last boss at headquarters. And he said, what are you doing here? I said, oh, I'm chief of counterterrorism here. What are you doing here? He said, I'm taking your prisoner onward. And I said, where are you taking him? And he said, I'm sorry, man, you don't have a need to know. I said, that's okay. And he said, who is this guy anyway? And I said, I'm sorry, man, you don't have a need to know. He said, fair enough. Which was true. Neither one of us really had a need to know the other's business. I'm glad I didn't know, frankly. And he left. I went back to headquarters about 2 months later. Abu Zubaydah was given about 8 weeks to recover from his wounds. He was shot in the thigh, the groin, and the stomach with an AK-47. The doctor in Pakistan at the military base told me that he had never seen wounds so severe where the patient had lived. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, the scene in his room was out of a horror movie. I've never seen so much blood in my life. We were covered in it. We had blood all over us. There was blood all over him. There was blood pooling on the floor underneath his bed. As quickly as they could pump blood into his body, it was leaking out onto the floor from these horrific wounds. But he did recover. And so the FBI sent a seasoned agent out to the secret location to begin interrogating him. This agent was named Ali Sufan. I worked very closely with Ali in Pakistan on a number of operations. And believe me, it's like a kick in my gut to have to compliment the FBI. But Ali was a fantastic FBI agent. And the FBI, look, let's face it, at the CIA, we're not trained interrogators. We like to think we are, and we like to tell people that we are, but we don't know what we're doing. The FBI knows what it's doing, and they've been doing it since the Second World War. And what they do is they try to establish a rapport with a subject. They try to establish a relationship with that subject. And sometimes that takes weeks, even months. But eventually, almost invariably, that subject begins talking. We saw it with Nazi war criminals. We saw it with double agents from the Soviet Union through the 1950s. We saw it with Al-Qaeda fighters. They would eventually talk. For whatever reason, George Tenet hated the fact that the FBI had primacy in this case. Remember, September 11th was still an open criminal investigation in 2002. That's why the FBI had primacy in this case. But it just stuck in George's craw that the FBI was interrogating Abu Zubaydah and the CIA was not. So in the summer of 2002, George went to the president and somehow convinced him to evict Ali Sufan and the other FBI personnel in country and to replace Ali Sufan with two contract psychologists, Mitchell and Jessen, who had been the creators of what became the so-called enhanced interrogation program. Then FBI Director Mueller was so incensed that his people were taken off the case that he ordered all FBI personnel out of the country because he knew it was going to happen. And he believed at the time that the CIA's, I'm going to call it the CIA's torture program, was a crime in and of itself. So all FBI personnel were removed from that country. Mueller said later that he determined that if this was really going to happen, the CIA was on its own, and they were not going to be able to rely on the FBI for even moral support. Ali returned to the United States. We know now from the Senate torture report that within hours of the withdrawal of FBI personnel, the CIA began torturing Abu Zubaydah. I should add that when I returned to headquarters in May of 2002, a senior officer in the CIA's counterterrorism center approached me and said, hey, I wanted to talk to you. Would you be interested in being certified in the use of enhanced interrogation techniques? I had never heard the term before. I said, well, what's that mean? And very excitedly, he said, we're going to start getting rough with these guys. I said, well, what does that mean? And he outlined a list of 10 tactics that were going to be used in these new CIA interrogations. I said, that sounds like a torture program to me. And I said, you know what? Let me think about it for an hour. Well, I went up to the seventh floor, the executive floor of the CIA. There was a very, very senior CIA officer for whom I had worked in the Middle East about a decade earlier. And I asked if I could have 5 minutes. I went into his office and I said, listen, this just happened to me down in the cafeteria. What do you think of this? And he said, and he denies that this conversation ever took place, but he said, first, let's call it what it is. It's a torture program. Number two, torture is a slippery slope. And you know how these guys are. Somebody's going to go overboard in the name of patriotism, right? And they're going to kill a prisoner. And when that happens, there's going to be a congressional investigation, and then there's going to be a Justice Department investigation, and somebody's going to go to prison. Do you want to go to prison? I said, no, I don't want to go to prison. I'm the only person who went to prison, it turns out. I said, no, I don't want to go to prison. I went back down to the Counterterrorism Center, and I said, this is a torture program, and I don't want to have anything to do with it. They had asked 14 people if they wanted to be certified in these torture techniques. 12 of us, I guess, said yes. Two said no. And one of the two who said no changed his mind and went through the training after all. Because I had said no, I was cut off from that compartment of information coming in from the secret site. But I got promoted. And I became the executive assistant up on the seventh floor, which then gave me access to the traffic coming back in from the secret site. So on or about the 1st of August, 2002, CIA contractors, not officers, CIA contractors began torturing Abu Zubaydah. Now, we can agree to disagree on some of these torture tactics. They include grabbing him by the lapels. All right, well, that's not really torture. We have a law in this country, actually, called the Federal Torture Act, which was passed back in the 40s, and it defines torture very specifically. And what it comes down to is it's anything that causes a person extreme pain, whether it's physically or emotionally. It doesn't have to leave a mark. It doesn't have to be permanent. It's anything that causes extreme mental or emotional pain. Now, beyond the Federal Torture Act, we are signatories, and not just signatories, but we were the authors of the United Nations Convention Against Torture, which has exactly the same definition of torture in its body. So it seems pretty clear to me that torture is illegal. Two Justice Department attorneys, Jay Bybee and John Yoo, somehow did a very acrobatic move in which they said that no, it's not torture, and even if it was, torture is legal. So it was legal for about 5 minutes in 2002 because these two idiots said so. With that said, within a day, these techniques graduated from grabbing him by the lapels to other things. Now, one of the techniques was something called walling. Walling was very, very specific in its definition. A plywood wall was supposed to have been constructed because plywood has some give to it. The prisoner is held up. He has a towel or one of those sleep pillows you see people having in the airports around his neck. And then he's pushed hard up against the wall so that he hits his head. But again, there's some give and his neck is protected. But they used a concrete wall, and oh, they forgot to put the towel on his head. They concussed him, is what ended up happening. Beyond that, they waterboarded him 83 times. I told ABC News in 2007 that Abu Zubaydah had been waterboarded once. The reason that I said that is because that's what was reported back to headquarters in the cable traffic, that he had been waterboarded once. That was a lie. We didn't know that that was a lie until the Inspector General revealed it in the spring of 2009 when his report on the torture program was declassified. Everything about this program was a lie. Everybody that was involved in it was lying. And what that senior officer had warned me about really did come true. I maintained from the very beginning that the worst technique was not waterboarding. Waterboarding's terrible. You feel like you're drowning and your body is reacting to this water being poured on your face. Your abdominal muscles tense. Your body releases lactic acid. And it's very painful, not necessarily as it's happening, but the day after or 2 days after. But there were things that were worse. For example, we used a technique on Abu Zubaydah and on other prisoners called the cold cell. In the cold cell, the prisoner is stripped naked, which is a violation of the Geneva Convention. He's chained to an eye bolt in the ceiling so that he can't sit or lay or rest or get comfortable in any way. His cell is chilled to 50 degrees, and then every hour, somebody goes into the cell and throws a bucket of ice water on him. We killed people using that technique, but no one was charged with murder or assault or depraved indifference or anything else. We killed people with that technique. There was nothing in the Justice Department's memo that said we could kill people. Another technique was sleep deprivation. Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, famously said that he didn't believe in sleep deprivation. He said, I work 2-3 days straight, and I have a stand-up desk in my office. I don't even sit down, and I pace around and walk around while I'm working. And if I can do it, these prisoners can do it. But we're not talking about 2 or 3 days of sleep deprivation. Again, according to the Senate torture report, And I'll add that the Senate torture report was based on primary source CIA documents. Primary source documents. The torture report said that people begin losing their minds at day 9. They begin dying at day 12. But the CIA was allowed to keep prisoners awake for 14 days. We end up with prisoners who are unable to participate in their own defenses because they've lost their minds. We also know from the Senate torture report that CIA officers went over and above the techniques that were permitted by the Justice Department. There's evidence of sexual assault where CIA contractors, anally penetrated prisoners with broomsticks. Where's that approved? I'd like to see the president's signature on that memo, because I don't remember any such memo in my experience. There's evidence that CIA contractors forced hummus, bean dip, rectally inside a prisoner, and then called it rectal rehydration. Show me one doctor in the world who forces hummus up somebody's rectum to rehydrate him. But no one was ever brought to justice. I don't care about my own personal experience post-ABC News. Water under the bridge. It makes no sense for me to focus on the past. I get nothing out of it. I have to focus on the future. But that future includes a fight against torture. Believe me when I say, it pains me to see that clearly a majority of American citizens support a torture program. Now, can we really be so ill-informed? My brother always says, well, that's America. It's like, no, that shouldn't be America. We're a country of laws, and we should follow those laws. I've written extensively on the fact that one of the things that's gravely missing at the CIA is an ethics program. There is no such thing as an ethics course at the CIA. New officers, whether they're new hires or new officers in the clandestine service, are given any training in ethics at all. And that, coupled with the fact that, according to a CIA psychiatrist, the CIA actively hires people with sociopathic tendencies. What do you think? People with sociopathic tendencies, not sociopaths, because sociopaths have no consciences. And they can easily pass polygraphs, but they're very hard to control. people with sociopathic tendencies are people who are comfortable working in moral, legal, or ethical gray areas. And I said, sure, that's me. If I need to get a document and documents in this guy's office, I'm going to break into the office. I'm going to steal it. That's the job. We're the good guys. That's what we do. But there's a difference between somebody with a sociopathic tendency and a sociopath. A sociopath will keep pushing and pushing and pushing until something terrible happens or a congressional oversight committee tells him, you can't do that anymore. I ask a question when I speak to colleges and universities. I'm going to ask the same question here. And I really, truly want to see a show of hands. Let's say that you are a CIA case officer and you have recruited a major penetration of a foreign terrorist group, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, it doesn't matter what it is. And you're meeting with this source in a hotel somewhere in the Middle East. And this source is fantastic. He's been vetted. He's been polygraphed. Everything that he's told you so far has turned out to be true. And you have used his information to disrupt attacks to save American lives. So you show up for this meeting. And here's your agent. He's there in the room. And he says, listen, I've given you everything you've asked of me. And now you're going to do something for me. I want you to go out right now and I want you to get me a prostitute. And if you don't, I'm not giving you any more information. How many people would go out and get him the prostitute? Sure. Just about for our radio listeners. Just about everybody said yes. Yeah, sure you would. Sure. He's a scumbag. Your job is to deal with scumbags. That's just what you do. It's the nature of the job. Certainly. What if he says he wants a child prostitute? No, nobody. No, absolutely not. Not in a million years. But the problem is there's no rule. I mean, just as a matter of course, when you do your job, you break the law every day. You're committing espionage every day. So what's the difference? You break this law, you break that law. You're committing espionage, you procure a child prostitute. A lot of people think that way. Well, it's part of the job. He's giving us good information. We're saving American lives. Sure, I'll go get him the 6-year-old prostitute. No, you won't get him the 6-year-old prostitute. But the problem is that they don't teach that at the CIA. They don't tell you, look, there's a line here that we're not supposed to cross. You know, at the agency, they always taught us that everything was a shade of gray. That's just not true. Some things are black and white. Some things are right and wrong. And torture is one of those things that's just plain wrong. A lot of people who, you know, say they oppose torture, but they supported the enhanced interrogation techniques, perhaps alleging that they weren't torture necessarily, will tell you about the ticking time bomb theory. Well, you know, what if you know that your prisoner has the information, a bomb's going to go off in New York, we have to get the information. Well, first of all, that never happens, ever. That's just in the movies. That's never, ever happened in real life, at least not as it relates to the CIA. Secondly, let's say you do torture him, and he does give you information. First of all, it's a proven scientific fact that most of the information gathered from torture is unreliable because the person being tortured will tell you exactly what he thinks you want to hear just to get you to stop torturing him. Let's say he does give you the information. It's mixed in with a whole bunch of information that is either nonsense or irrelevant. And so you're going to have to turn all of it over to an analyst so the analyst can go through it and figure out what's true or not. Well, that's going to take 2 or 3 weeks. By then, New York is a dust cloud. So what's the difference? It just doesn't work. This is what I hope I can do with the rest of my life. I'm sure the agency would rather that I keep my mouth shut. Actually, they've told me that they would rather I keep my mouth shut. I'm not going to do that. I love the agency. I've always loved the agency. I had a fabulous career there. I worked with brave and honorable men and women, thousands of them. But I believe that we've had a string of CIA leaders who have been sociopaths. And that has to change. We need a change at the top. We need a change in the congressional oversight committees. and we need training because, as sad as it is, people need to be taught right and wrong. And torture is wrong. I am trying very hard. I kept it to 39 minutes. It was supposed to be 40. And I would be very, very happy to take whatever questions you might have. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, John. That was wonderful. Not uplifting, but wonderful. Thomas Andrew Drake, a former executive with the NSA, who along with you and Jeslyn Radick was featured in the film Silenced, has said that the NSA should be dismantled, or at the very least, substantially reformed, and maximum disclosure, public disclosure of everything the NSA is doing should be made available. Do you agree with him? And in your judgment, should that also be the case with the CIA?
I'll preface my answer by saying I love Tom Drake. He's like a brother to me. But no, I don't agree. I agree in part. I want NSA to intercept the communications of foreign leaders. I want NSA to intercept the communications of enemies of the United States. That's what they're supposed to do. That's what they were created to do in the late 1940s. I do believe that NSA has gone rogue, for lack of a better term. It is against the law, and it is a violation of NSA's charter to collect information on American citizens, more than American citizens, on what are called U.S. persons. That's any American citizen and any person in the United States on a green card. It is illegal. It is none of the government's business what we write in our emails, what we say in our phone conversations, or what we say in our text messages. If they have a reason to collect that information, they should turn it over to the FBI, and the FBI should seek a warrant. Again, we're a nation of laws, and that means that we all have to follow the laws. Now, I do believe that there has to be broad reform, not just of NSA, but of CIA as well. I lament the fact all the time that Frank Church is dead, and Pat Moynihan is dead, and nobody on Capitol Hill has the balls to stand up to the CIA. I wrote an op-ed this morning while I was waiting to come here, and it was based on a Washington Post report about a tiff between General Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, and the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. The SSCI wanted to pass a bill that would require the agency to inform the committee if anybody being promoted into leadership positions at the CIA had ever been convicted of a crime or had ever been accused of domestic violence. Well, they didn't like that. They said it was none of the committee's business if anybody's been accused of domestic violence or convicted of a crime. Well, of course it's the Oversight Committee's business. They're overseeing. That's what they're supposed to be doing. And I said in this op-ed, I would go farther than that. I've worked for CIA officers who use taxpayer money to buy prostitutes for themselves. I worked for a CIA officer who beat his wife repeatedly, had his gun taken away, and then after 9/11, they said, you probably should take the gun back. Just don't beat your wife anymore. Where is the oversight? You can't oversee something like this if you don't even know that it's taking place. And so I do believe in broad reforms being necessary, both at NSA and CIA.
Here are two questions related to General Petraeus, who has provided, of course, more classified information to his mistress than you, yet he wasn't charged under the Espionage Act or Intelligence Identities Protection Act. And he was sentenced to only 2 years of probation and a $100,000 fine. Another question says, seems like a waste of government money and effort to spend pursuing charges on you and now managing your probation. A better point would be made by doing more against Petraeus. Your take on that, please?
God bless you, first of all. The morning that General Petraeus was charged, a very, very dear friend of mine at the CIA called me and said, please don't criticize Petraeus today. He's a really good friend of mine. And I thought, you know, as hard as it was, of course, you know, every journalist in America called me that day. And I said, again, this was like a kick in my gut. I said, I don't believe General Petraeus should have been charged with a crime because he had no criminal intent and there was no harm to the national security, just as in my case. And I kept to that for a while. But, you know, with Petraeus, on the day of his sentencing, well, let me add, I took a plea to having confirmed the name of a former colleague to a journalist. I did it. I'm sorry I did it. It was stupid. It was a momentary lapse in judgment. I shouldn't have done it, but I did it. That name was never made public. The journalist never publicized the name. So no one knows what the name is. But still, I got 2.5 years in prison for that email conversation. General Petraeus revealed the name of 10 covert operatives to his girlfriend. In addition to that, he revealed to her copies of what are called the Black Books. These are the holy of holies of CIA secrets that are known in their entirety only to the president and to the director of the CIA, and now to Petraeus' girlfriend. He was charged with one misdemeanor count of failure to secure classified information. He got 18 months of unsupervised probation. At his sentencing hearing, after passing sentencing, the judge came down from his bench to shake his hand and thank him for his service to the country. And the very next day, he flew to Iraq on a consulting contract for the White House. Mm-hmm. We were talking last night. I still owe my lawyers $880,000 in legal bills. I'm a convicted felon. I lost my federal pension. I can't vote. Where's the equity? I said to my attorney, kind of naively, I said, why do I get what I got? And Petraeus got what he got. And he said, because Petraeus didn't blow the whistle on the CIA's torture program. I mean, despite what the prosecutors would have you believe. And the judge made a point to say, you are not a prosecutor, Mr. Kiriakou. You are a leaker. Well, you know what? It's not up to Judge Leonie Brinkema to decide who is a whistleblower and who is not. Because there's a legal definition of whistleblowing, and that is bringing to light any evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. And that's exactly what I did. So I am not a Petraeus fan. I will never be a Petraeus fan. I think Petraeus is a phony. I think that prosecutorial, what do they call it? Prosecutorial discretion be damned. He was an insider. He was a player. And when you're a friend of the president, or you have 4 shiny stars on your shoulder, you're going to get a pass. There's a major presidential candidate right now that looks like she's going to get a pass. You know, when you're a 4-star general who is identified in the New York Times as the president's favorite general, General James Cartwright, who allegedly told the New York Times that the U.S. government created the Stuxnet virus to infect the Iranian nuclear weapons program. You get a pass for that, too. I mean, that meets the government's definition of espionage. The definition of espionage is incredibly broad, probably unconstitutionally broad. But to commit espionage, you have to provide national defense information to any person not entitled to receive it, period. This law, the Espionage Act, is so old, it was written in 1917 to combat German saboteurs during the First World War. It doesn't even mention classified information because the classification system wasn't even created for another 40 years, and it's never been updated. So virtually anybody with a security clearance can be charged with espionage if the government wants to charge them. But like I say, if you are a friend of the president or have those 4 shiny stars on your shoulder, you're not going to get an espionage charge. If you're Tom Drake or John Kiriakou or Jeffrey Sterling or Stephen Kim and you're not you're part of the in crowd and you blow the whistle on waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, you're going to go to prison. And that's exactly what's happened. Interestingly enough, it's happened really only under this president, this champion of transparency, who's currently leading us. Between 1917 and 2009, three Americans were charged with espionage for providing national defense information to the press. Three. Since Barack Obama was elected, he has charged nine people, three times the number of all previous presidents combined. Nine people for leaking information to the press. Where's the transparency there?
Question about Edward Snowden. What's your take on him?
I think Ed Snowden is a national hero. I really do. I'm sorry if that's controversial. I would not have provided all the information that he certainly has, but we would not have known that our government was spying on us without Ed Snowden. And I've urged him both publicly and privately not to come back to the United States because he will not get a fair trial here. The government does something called venue shopping, which ought to be illegal. What they do is they look for the federal district that is the toughest on people accused of your crime. For example, Snowden. Snowden was living and working in Hawaii when he made his revelations. Hawaii is in the Northern District of California, based in San Francisco. NSA is in Fort Meade, Maryland. That's the Southern District of Maryland. But Snowden was charged in the Eastern District of Virginia, in Alexandria, Virginia. Why? Because no national security defendant has ever won a case in the Eastern District of Virginia. When the jury is going to be made up of people from the CIA, the FBI, DOD, DHS, federal national security contractors, you don't have a prayer in the Eastern District of Virginia. And no crime was committed in the Eastern District of Virginia, but that doesn't matter. What matters is the Justice Department is virtually guaranteed of a conviction there. Now, General Petraeus did give his girlfriend the names and the documents in the Eastern District of Virginia, but he was charged in the Western District of North Carolina, right? Where they have thousands and thousands of military retirees who love what Petraeus did in Afghanistan. And where's the justice there? There is no justice there.
Several people have wondered about the presidential candidates and what kind of information or advice you would give them. You've said that in a world of unprecedented threats, that we need to strike a balance, and I'm quoting from your book, I believe, we need to strike a balance between protecting our national security and ensuring the rights guaranteed by our Constitution. Please give us your best thinking as to how that balance can be achieved, and what would you advise those currently seeking the presidency?
I would urge all of those currently seeking the presidency to respect civil liberties and to respect the Constitution of the United States. Our problems with September 11th, with Al-Qaeda, with Hezbollah before it, with ISIS today, are not because we have too many freedoms as Americans. They're because the CIA did not do its job in infiltrating those groups and disrupting the attacks. So the solution is not to take freedoms away from Americans. The solution is to appoint better leaders at the CIA, to be better at training, certainly to be better at teaching foreign languages that would allow us to infiltrate these groups, conduct operations that allow us to disrupt them and their attacks. That's what the CIA is supposed to do. That's what it ought to be doing every single day around the world. The solution is not an offshore prison where nobody can face his accusers in a court of law. The solution is not to launch drone strikes to murder American citizens overseas, which has happened three times under this president. The solution is to respect the Constitution that has governed us for the past 240 years. I'm sorry to say that there were really only two major presidential candidates that have exhibited this respect for the Constitution And that was Bernie Sanders and Rand Paul. Rand Paul, of course, never had any chance of being elected president. Bernie Sanders, I think, might. And I think that at least on issues of civil liberties, he's saying the right thing. I will add that there's a third candidate whom I like and respect very much, and that's Gary Johnson. He's the Libertarian Party candidate and the former two-term governor of New Mexico. He takes the Constitution very seriously and really is the only candidate from any party, major or minor, who has come out in support of our constitutional civil liberties and has said that he would ban torture in any of its forms.
Has the CIA continued its torture techniques and programs since the revelations that have come out?
I don't think so. They say that they have not. I don't mean to sound cynical or bitter, but look, everything the CIA has told us since September 11th has been a lie. And so I really want to believe that there is no torture program. I want to believe that there are no secret prisons. I want to believe that people's human rights are being respected in Afghanistan, but I don't think they are. I just don't trust them. Let me add one thing. I've worked with these guys, right? I mean, I remember having conversations with colleagues of mine at the agency where we would point at a coworker who, you know, by now is in a very senior leadership position and say, the guy's a psychopath. I mean, his wife says it, for God's sake. And now he's, you know, in a leadership position at the agency. So are we supposed to believe him and take his word for it that nobody's being tortured? I don't.
Sort of in the same vein, how accurate is the official version of how Osama bin Laden's hiding place was discovered as portrayed in the film Zero Dark Thirty?
Right. Oh, boy. Oh, my goodness. Zero Dark Thirty was a grave disservice to the American people. It perpetuated this lie that torture led to Osama bin Laden. It did not. Really great analysis led to Osama bin Laden. You know, really terrific analysts who devoted their lives to this kind of thing led to Osama bin Laden. You know, we always knew that bin Laden would make a mistake. The tables were turned. You know how we always say that we have to be right all the time and the terrorists only have to be lucky once? Well, in this case, bin Laden had to be right all the time and we only had to be lucky once, and we got lucky. We got lucky because we learned of the courier. We got lucky because the courier got lazy and used the same internet cafe multiple times, which he never, ever should have done. But to see the pattern of events as they were in Zero Dark Thirty was just simply not true. I've spoken to Mark Boll, the screenwriter for Zero Dark Thirty, and he believes that he was duped by the agency, that the agency fed him the official line, pretended that it was insider information, and he ran with it. And it was just a lie. And I'll add that Leon Panetta, who has never been charged with espionage or with violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, Leon Panetta gave classified briefings to Mark Boll and to Catherine Bigelow, the director of Zero Dark Thirty, over a classified mock-up of the bin Laden compound. But that's okay, right? Because they're going to do this great movie talking about how great the agency is. After that, which the inspector general has jumped up and down about, after that, he gave a speech, sort of an attaboy speech, in the bubble, the agency's auditorium. Boll and others were invited to attend the speech. None of them are cleared. But in that speech, Panetta revealed the name of the Navy SEAL who actually killed bin Laden. That is a violation of the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1981. It's punishable by up to 10 years in prison. And in addition, the classified briefings that he provided are a violation of the Espionage Act, punishable by up to 5 years in prison. Why wasn't Petraeus arrested and charged with these crimes? Judge Leni Brinkema, who handled my case, Jeffrey Sterling's case, Ed Snowden's case, said that she would not respect precedent in her district or in her circuit that would hold that there had to be criminal intent or harm to the national security. So my attorneys asked, "Your Honor, are you saying that a person can accidentally commit espionage?" And she said, "That's exactly what I'm saying." Well, if we're going to be equal and we're going to be just, Panetta should be charged with espionage. Petraeus should be charged with espionage. John Brennan, Mike Morrell, anybody that participated in the briefings for Zero Dark 30, there was an article in Vice News day before yesterday saying that the agency is now contributing to episodes of one of these cooking shows, the Magic Chef or whatever the thing is, where you have to prepare a dinner for the director of the CIA using secret ingredients. Seriously, this is what it's come to? We're supposed to be the world's premier intelligence agency, and we're on the Magic Chef Food Network? We should be ashamed of ourselves. But this is how things have gone askew since September 11th.
We're just about out of time. One last question, hopefully a quick response. Your view on the Apple FBI phone information access issue.
I've written extensively about this issue, and I'm strongly, solidly on the side of Apple. And it's because this isn't really about terrorism. Not at all. The New York Times said yesterday that there are actually more than a dozen cases in which the FBI has quietly asked district court judges around the country to order Apple to unlock their phones. So it's not about terrorism. It's about routine, run-of-the-mill drug cases. And, you know, the FBI doesn't always use warrants or court orders. They have this nonsense called national security letters, which allow them to just write a letter, take it to the provider, whether it's Apple or Sprint or whomever, and say, "Listen, national security, you have to give us everything." Well, no, they don't have to give you everything. We have a constitution. And the constitution says that you have to go to court and get a warrant. Plain and simple. And I think that we should hold the FBI to that.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much. Very, very much. Thank you. Pleasure being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.